Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the church.
I extol those who with loving care and compassionate concern feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and house the homeless. He who notes the sparrows fall will not be unmindful of such service.
The Mormon Channel now presents Faith in Action.
Hello and welcome to Faith in Action, a show that explores the humanitarian and welfare work members of the church are performing worldwide. I'm your host, Robert Hendricks. Today we join you from our radio studio inside the Conference Center on Temple Square in Salt Lake City. We're joined today by three men, all from Utah, but who work in the Dominican Republic, spend much of their time in that country doing what most young boys dream of, treasure hunting at the bottom of the ocean. And when they're not underwater, they're helping to improve the lives of people in the Dominican Republic. And we welcome you all here today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let me introduce Wilf Bloom, who is the mastermind and the chief captain of this outfit, I suppose.
Well, I don't know. Chief captain, that's pretty big. No, I'm the president of the company.
All right. And Randy Champion, and you have worked for the church in the past and now doing PR for Wilf, is that correct?
Yes. I also do the media relations and on occasion get to go down and film underwater and do all kinds of fun stuff.
All right. And Ron Hartley, your position with the group?
I've been with the group for about 2 years now, and I just keep everyone under control.
Ah, that's a tough job. I can tell from looking at these guys.
I'm the conscience of the company.
Are you?
We call him Jiminy Cricket.
The name of the outfit is Deep Blue Marine. And I've got to go to St. Matthew for a moment here. Pardon me. St. Matthew 6, verses 19 and 20. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. Two verses, both of them explaining kind of what you do. First, treasure hunting, and then helping people with the proceeds from that treasure.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, because that's a scripture that usually comes to mind when we do this. Mm-hmm. And last week I taught my Sunday school class on laying up treasures in heaven. And it's interesting because when you lay out all the stuff we bring up, nobody took it to heaven with them. Mm-hmm. And on most of the shipwrecks that we bring up, the people on them have deceased. But now there are some other people in our line of work who, some very interesting things. You'll find sometimes little clumps of coins, mm-hmm, or jewels, and quite often beside them you'll find a rosary, which tells you that person who died was down there, could not let go of his treasure, and was doing his rosary as he was dying under the ocean. It's kind of a sad reflection on the human condition. The very thing that they fought their whole life to get was the thing that killed him.
Well, let me ask you where this whole thing started. Sitting in an easy chair one day or driving down the road, how did the whole thing hatch? What happened?
You know, this is going to sound like a thing for BYU Education Week, but I was at BYU Education Week with my wife, and I got a phone call. We were in the Marriott Center, and I stepped outside and I answered my phone, and it was a fellow from North Carolina looking to borrow a substantial amount of money to go treasure hunting. And so I came back to the office after that, looked at it, researched a little bit, and invited him to come to Utah. He came to Utah. We had three subsequent meetings with him in different parts of the world, and he was either so drunk or so stoned he couldn't talk to us, and never kept any of his obligations to us. And by this time, I'd committed a fair amount of resources to the industry. And so I looked at it and said, well, if I'm going to do this, I guess I'm going to have to do it on my own. And I built the company and started going at it. But I'd already committed over $250,000 to it, to his efforts, but had to withdraw that and start on my own to save the money I'd put into it. And that was in 2005. And then you came to work, when did you come with us, Randy?
2006.
Yeah, so I started the company November 15th, 2005. January 5th, we really opened up our offices here in Utah full-time, and you came in May, wasn't it?
May of 2006, I was there.
Now, I've known Randy since we were in 11th grade together in Grand Prairie, Alberta, Canada. And so it was when Randy walked in my office, I thought, wow, I got the help I need. And And Randy's been a great addition ever since.
So if you think it's strange that a company from the desert is diving for treasure, how about two guys from the frozen north?
Well, let's make it three.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Ron too. I forgot. Ron's from Alberta,
I met
too.
Ron in Edmonton, Alberta.
You got three Albertans here, actually.
In 1976, I met you.
So you kind of come across this business secondhand. You all of a sudden are going, well, I've got enough invested. It's mine, I guess. So
it wasn't even that. I had put together the money to finance his company mm-hmm. out of my own resources. Mm-hmm. And then he just kind of fell off the edge of the world. Wow. And so here I am with all this put together, everything I needed to do to accomplish what I wanted to do with him. And he was no longer involved in the industry. So I went forward and did it on my own.
Had you ever stepped foot on a ship that size, the size that you're using before? Was this just totally random?
It was just totally random. I've been on a cruise once before.
Mm-hmm.
But to think, if you would have told me 8 years ago that I'd own four ships out in the ocean recovering treasure, come on, Bob. But that's what's happened. It's amazing. Our smallest vessel, is, of course, owned by Captain Billy. We lease that one.
Mm-hmm.
But we have two 88-ton vessels and another 45-ton vessel, and they're big boats. And they can handle anything the ocean throws at them. So,
now those boats are costing you money every day, whether they're working or not.
So we work them lots.
You work them lots.
Yeah, it costs us about $2,500 a day to run our company, whether we're on the water or on the couch. So we're on the water.
How do you find, is it old treasure maps? Is it, how do you find the treasure that you're looking for? Are there trade secrets? I mean,
there's not really any trade secrets to it. Believe it or not, one of the first wrecks I ever found, I had a treasure map.
With an X on it.
Yeah, with an X on it. Here I am, 55 years old, out in the middle of the ocean, digging around in it with a treasure map. But what we do now is we're a little more sophisticated. We use magnetometers and side-scan sonar. We also have a secret weapon we use, and what we do is we go to the local fishermen. They've plied those waters for decades, mm-hmm. and they know where every anchor, every cannon, every piece of a ship is laying. And so then we just bring them along and pay them well for their efforts and go dive those sites that are in our permitted area. Now, we have a permitted area. We can't just go out and start diving anywhere we want. So we work in a specific permitted area.
And who issues those permits?
The government of the Dominican Republic.
Okay.
And it's done through the subaquatica. Well, how do they say it in Spanish, Randy?
Subaquatico.
Subaquatico. My Spanish is about as good as my Japanese, and that's as good as my Chinese, which is not nearly as good as my English.
Okay. So the Dominican Republic gives you permission. Do you have to buy rights to this specific area?
No, they can't do that. That's against the law in that particular country.
Okay.
And it would be against the law in America, too. There is an absolute section of American law that forbids us from paying bribes or things like that. And the government down there is very conscientious of that aspect. They try to run their business like a true democracy. And so we go there. Once we have agreed upon a permitted site, then we pay $3,000 a month for that permit. But we don't pay anything in advance for it.
You mentioned a captain, and I understand there is a captain here at the Moran Eye Center having some surgery or having some
Captain work. Billy. Mm-hmm. Billy's been with us. He came right after Randy, didn't he?
About a year after me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Billy's been with us now. This is going into his fifth year. He's our principal boat captain. Billy is an amazing guy. He brought his first boat in when he was 15 years old, and that's a big deal. I'm not talking a little boat either. This was a big ocean-going boat, and the captain of the boat had passed out due to being a little bit drunk, and Billy wasn't a drinker, so he took the helm and brought the boat in. And when the guy finally woke up, they were tied up to the dock in the Bahamas, 15 years old. And he's been on the ocean ever since, and he's 50 now, isn't he?
50, just turned 50.
And he's having a little bit of trouble with his right eye. And so we brought him into the Moran Eye Center, and they're looking at it today, and we'll know more on that tomorrow.
You mentioned that you give him a lot of the credit for finding some of the wrecks that you've found. Is it intuition with him, or is it the communication with the fishermen, or how does this happen with
him? You know, it's hard to say, Robert, but I grew up in the mountains in Grand Prairie, okay? So I can go out there, and I can see stuff that I remember. But, Randy, you know, too, we'd be out on the ocean with Billy, nothing but water around us, and he'd say, okay, this is where we were yesterday. How do you know that? And it's just the guy has grown up on the ocean, and he keeps you safe. He keeps the boat safe. And then he looks at the shorelines. Most of the work we do is right up against shore.
Mm-hmm.
And Billy looks at the shorelines, and he says, if I were in a storm, this is where I would head. And that's kind of how it happens.
I gotcha. All
right. And then, of course, you drag the mag and the side scan, and sure enough, there's something there to look at.
When you find something, I guess it's just sixes, whether it's something great or something small, but I would imagine that every find is exciting for you.
Yeah, it's the most exciting thing you've found, Randy.
They're all historical. That's the important thing. Different things. Some are wrecks where there might be treasure. Others are wrecks where they might have been a slave ship or maybe it was a fighting vessel. And so they're all important in their own way. We have one that we call the bottle wreck. It was just full of bottles. Now they're not as valuable as gold and silver coins would be, but there's something historically significant about that. And so each wreck tells its own story, and that's part of the fun of recovering these wrecks, is finding the history of them and why did it go down? What was it carrying? Where was it going? Where did it come from?
Was there something in these bottles at some
point? Oh, sure.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes they're empty, but sometimes, as a matter of fact, we'll find bottles that still have the cork in them. And there may be oil and vinegar. It might be salad dressing in there, or maybe it's wine or something else. So, sure, sometimes we find them with things in them.
For me, it's a much more personal thing sometimes. I remember a previous wreck that we worked on. Le Scipion was a French wreck, French warship that fought in the War of Independence. And the first time I dove on that, we were working under some cannons. And as you remove some of the sand with some of the machinery that we have, you know, a couple of coins come sliding down. So you put those in your hand. And my question always is, well, who did these belong to? Who was the last person to touch these? Every artifact that I'm associated with has a personal story to me. And I think it's exciting to think, what is the history of that thing? And whether it's a coin or whether it's a musket ball from a gun, it doesn't matter. It has a history, and it's exciting.
What is the most unusual find, in your opinion, that you have found?
I think that one's pretty easy. It's on the wreck we're on right now, where we're pulling up a lot of artifacts from the mid-1500s.
Well, even prior to that, we're pulling up artifacts that are Mayan. You know, they were old when they were put on this boat.
And the seven jade statues. But I'll tell you the thing that I look at, for me personally, that is the most unusual thing. I was digging on Le Scipion. Le Scipion is still kind of, I really like that boat. And I was digging on there, and I found a place. I had just studied the power and the strength of the cannons. And a 36-pound gun shoots a 36-pound cannonball, which is 7 inches round. With 18 pounds of powder, it will penetrate 39 solid inches of oak at 600 meters. So you know this has got some power. It's like our nuclear weapon. As I was digging on that ship, I was on the inside wall that had fallen down, was laying flat on the ocean floor. Embedded inside that wall, deep into it, was a 36-pound cannonball. So you know it came through the other side and stopped before it went out the side I was on. And around it were 7 more cannonballs that were embedded in the wall. And there had been 15 men killed on that ship in its last battle. And you kind of can get the picture of where that happened. And so, you know, to me, I was touching the last major battle event of that ship. And that was, to me, the most startling, most surreal aspect of what we've ever done, to me.
And hearing that, Bob, you might think, well, boy, that must have been quite a battle that took that ship down. Well, it wasn't the battle that took that ship down. That ship was able to outrun the English ship that was after it and was making its escape, came around a corner into this bay, hit what they called a high deep or a coral reef, and that's what took the ship down. And that was a ship that had fought actually in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, fought for America.
In the War of Independence.
Fought in the Virginia Capes battle at Chesapeake, fought in Pensacola and the Battle of the Saints. And then the Mona Passage, and then went down 20 minutes after hitting a coral head.
Hmm. The crews on these ships, generally from one country or another, why are they sailing through this area in the Dominican? Where are they going? Where are they coming from?
Do you guys want to answer that? Or do you want me to answer?
Well, sure. That's where all the shipping lanes in the early history of the New World, that's where the shipping lanes went through. They went right along the Dominican Republic, typically on the north shore of the Dominican Republic, but sometimes on the south. And if we had a map, we could show you. But it's just the ships were coming from Europe or going to Europe. And they were coming from or going to usually Mexico. And they came right along that north shore, and a lot of them got hit by hurricanes. You know, people often think, well, these ships, they go down out in the middle of the ocean. But they don't. Most of them go down because they've been in a hurricane. They're blown into shore, and they hit the reef, and the ship goes down. That's why we're finding so many along the north shore of the DR.
Plus, you know, Havana was a stopping point for the last, I guess, refurbishing of the ships as they headed back to Europe. And, you know, that's not too far from the Dominican Republic. It's just west of it. And so with the prevailing currents and with hurricanes and everything, we really are on the freeway of where these ships went.
Very interesting, because you do think, you know, you've seen movies where they're at on the high seas and this big battle ensues and the ship sinks, but this is not the case then.
Well, that happened. Most of the shipwrecks are going to be fairly close to shore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of the stuff we're after, merchantmen. Now, occasionally you'll get a war vessel like La Scipion, but that's not very often. Most of the time we're after merchantmen that have gone down as a result of storm.
I went to your website and saw a picture of the boats and also a museum that you have. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I thought of the museum. Randy made it happen. It's kind of like I have all these wild ideas, and I turn to Randy and Ron and whoever else is in the office and say, hey, can we do this? And they say, sure.
It's interesting when you think about it, because it was just over a year ago. It was around Christmas, a year and a quarter ago, that Will came up with this idea. And what we did, Bob, the first thing we did is we went over to our church building. We went into the gym, and we laid out on the floor kind of, if we were to build a museum, how would it work? And we looked at the size, and we laid out walls and stuff using blue tape on the floor. And that was just over a year ago, and now that museum has been open since September, and it's a place where we've been able to give back a little bit to the Dominican people. So rather than taking all these artifacts that we're finding and bringing them back to America, we thought, why not build a museum there in Samaná, which is close to where the wreck was that we were on. And we put this museum there, and it's a place where now the Dominicans can come and look at their own history, because there it is in the museum.
And it was actually, you know, something that we talked about for a long time. There are other diving companies in that area of the world as well, but we wanted to be known as the company that gives back to the people. And so that was the premise that we had approached the government authorities down there, saying, we want to be part of your community. We want to be part of the Dominican people. And so we have other plans as well, as far as English as a second language. But we wanted to be able to build this museum for the Dominican people and to give back to them. And like Ron mentioned, to show them their history as well.
What type of things would we see in the museum? What is there?
When you come in the front door, of course, the first thing you see there, we have kind of an interpretive center, an electronic interpretive center. Then you turn left, there's a model ship of La Scipion. Then you turn, you go down, we have rigging blocks, tackle. We have anchors. We have cannons in there, cannonballs, muskets, swords, all the things that there was another fellow who helped us with it named Alan Baird. Randy and Alan actually pounded most of the nails for that. Randy did a lot of the design work and a lot of the final treatments on it. And so when that museum was built, the whole concept was that we built like the inside of a ship. Now, when you go over to the Church History Museum here on just outside of Temple Square, you'll go into that room that shows the ship, and they've got the hanging knees and the bunks and everything. Mm-hmm. Well, we've kind of incorporated those aspects into our museum there. And so when you come in, then you see the captain's quarters, the crew's quarters. You see there's a full, completely restored cannon in there, an 18-pounder. It weighs 4,500 pounds. There's a helm that was built by my son-in-law, and Cohen Egli and Nick Snow built that. And then there's all kinds of photographs in there. You have five electronic centers in there, right, Randy? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have the flat screens where we show videos.
And then we have a little conservation lab that has a glass wall so people can stand there and watch the archaeologists as they put things together.
Because that's where we actually will bring a lot of the artifacts that we pull up. We'll put them in the conservation lab there and work on them. And so people that come through the museum, there's a big window they can look through and actually see the archaeologists working on some of these things.
Yeah, it's pretty cool because, like, we found one pile of pottery, just smashed up pottery. We brought it up and put that back together, 43 pieces. Ended up being about a 2.5-foot-high water jug. And then we found another piece on the wreck site we're on right now that they put together 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, the olive jar.
And it's an olive jar from the 1500s, and it's beautiful. And they're, you know, these are smashed into lots and lots of pieces, dozens of pieces.
But a good archaeologist can put those together just like a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah.
One of the great things about the museum, this was Randy's idea, was as you go in, you actually feel like you're inside a ship. It's all built. It's sailcloth up overhead, so it looks like a sail. The walls of the museum actually curve in at the bottom, like a ship's wall would do. So it's really interesting when you get in there. You feel like you're inside the ship.
We have that sound system. It's got the creaking and the noise of the waves and everything.
And, and then the nice thing, too, is we had blueprints of this ship. So Randy was able to take the blueprints of the ship and have different aspects, like the kitchen. They made one of the ovens, and they made the crew quarters and the captain's quarters to look like they would on the ship. So that was really – it's kind of – we like it. And the Dominicans seem to like it. The government really enjoys it. They bring a lot of people through there.
Well, really, you know, the museum's neat, and we're not going to make money really from this museum. At least we haven't yet. We might eventually. But what it does, it gives the locals something to be proud of. We can go in and we can look at some of these historical artifacts that went down in our waters. And Deep Blue brought them up, and here we can go and look at them. They didn't just take them all home.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Faith in Action on the Mormon Channel. Today we're talking with an interesting group of brethren. You might call them modern-day treasure hunters. I guess you are. But they're not all just about bars of gold and silver coins and whatever. Their unconventional line of work, they found a way to help people in need. Let me ask, and we're talking with Wilf Bloom, Randy Champion, and Ron Hartley from a company called Blue Marine, Deep Blue Marine, excuse me. Billy says it's down there. What happens now? Is it down here is 20 feet deep, or is it 30 feet deep?
It depends. Once Billy finds a wreck site for us, then the real work begins. And we go down and we start moving sand. And, for example, on the Scipion, we probably had to move down 8 to 10 feet of sand. On the wreck site we're on right now, we can go as deep as 20 feet in different areas where we're actually moving sand. We do that with what are called airlifts. Now, once you find the wreck site, that's just the beginning of the work. And they don't look like you would think. Like, I remember when I first started this, we're going to go down and be a ship laying there. And I, you know, in my mind, I had it figured out how I was going to do that. There'd be a boat there, and we'd have to move a mast.
Watch too many movies.
Yeah, I've seen too much of your work. But it's not like that. It's just a flat ocean floor. And you go in, you look at it, and then you try to decide, according to prevailing winds, different things, where you're going to find the first artifacts. And you pick that up with your metal detectors and your side scan and your mags. And then you go down, you get a hit on your metal detector, and you'll open that up. And it might be a cannonball, it might be a musket, it might be anything. For example, last time I dove, I was in an area that was maybe, 3.5 feet long, about like from me to you, and about 18 inches wide. And it was in between two big lava flumes. And I went in there and I got some hits on my metal detector, so I started digging in there, and I found 12 ship spikes. Then I found a 2-pound cannonball. And then I found 9 pieces of shrapnel shot. And I still had my metal detector ringing, so I pulled up this rock, and this rock looked like the void side of a cannonball. You could see where the cannonball had come out of it. So it was not really a rock, it was incrustation, but it was still ringing. And so I laid it up on one of those stones, and I tapped it a couple times with my hammer, and it broke in half, and there were 2 silver coins inside of it. So you never know what you're going to find. Now, you can come close to figuring out. Like on La Scipion, for example, we had blueprints of that ship. And we could go in, and I remember digging specifically where I found the 7 cannonballs embedded in the side, or the 7 shrapnel balls and the 1 big cannonball. I remember specifically thinking, well, if I'm where I think I am, there should be another cannon about 6 or 7 feet behind me. And sure enough, there it was. And then there should be something over here that I could identify. And as I went through that wreck site, I could identify those aspects of it. But that's not typical of a wreck site. You might find a couple cannons and an anchor laying on top of the sand. Everything else is under the sand.
Well, and the thing you have to realize is that after 450 years, which is about how long it's been on the ship that we're on right now, there really isn't any wood left. So you don't go down and find a ship. The wood is all gone. What you find are just remnants.
So this is just really destroying my whole vision of finding a shipwreck.
Yeah, it really is.
Unless just not happening.
Unless, of course, like on La Scipion, though, once we moved the sand, we started finding ship's timbers.
But that ship went down in 1782. So
yeah, that's only 226 years old. Mm-hmm. When we were on, it was 226 years old. The one we're on now went down roughly 1554. That's roughly the time period from the artifacts we've seen and the aging we've done on them. So it's roughly 1554 is what we're thinking. Now, we could be wrong. We could be out 2 years, 3 years, any direction on that.
Yeah, but that's close. And when you think, that's 60 years after Columbus was plying those waters.
You know, it's interesting also, the average lifespan of a wooden ship is about 3 or 4 years, because in the Caribbean they have these worms, these big worms about the size of your finger, that destroys wood. And so certainly any time a boat sinks, there's nothing left of it within a few years anyways. The Scipion was different because it was also situated in a bay where a freshwater river ran right over it, and there were not as many worms in that area. And so we are able to find large sections of wood there. But generally speaking, these older ships, there's nothing left of them.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Faith in Action on the Mormon Channel. Today we're talking with an interesting group of brethren. You might call them modern-day treasure hunters. But they're not all just about bars of gold and silver coins. Through their unconventional line of work, they found a way to help people in need. Let me ask you about service that you're doing now. This is amazing. How did this come about? Now, you have ships that are going back and forth, running through the Dominican Republic, and you're working with the people from the Dominican Republic. You see a need. What happens now?
Well, that actually started from my daughter, Carrie. Carrie's now serving a mission for the church over in Africa. She's in the South Johannesburg, South Africa mission, laboring in Francistown, Botswana. But when she was 18, was she, Randy?
Yeah, about 3 years ago.
Yeah, about 18.
Yeah.
We were going to send our boat, the Carly Ann, down. I have twin daughters, Carrie Lynn and Carly Ann. So we have a boat named Carly Ann, one named Carrie Lynn.
And they're twin boats.
And they're twin boats, made by the same company within a week of each other, which is kind of weird. That was an accident, but worked out. And then we have another boat called the Amber Jane, which is my other daughter. But Carrie said, maybe we should take some food and stuff down to the people, because we just had, that year we had just had a big hurricane in December, which was very late for the hurricane season. And so she got in touch with she kind of went on our blog, on our website, and a fellow by the name of Wayne Haskett out of Chicago jumped all over it. And her and Wayne put this together. And then I had a pretty good friend here in Utah who put us in touch with the Church Welfare Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And they donated 18,000 pounds of rice and beans. And then Wayne Haskett out of Chicago brought, there was a non-denominational Christian church and a Baptist church who donated literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds of clothing and paint and building supplies.
And then also he tracked down a shoe store that went out of business, and they donated all of their brand new shoes. It was really a great humanitarian effort. And we looked at this boat that was heading down totally empty, and we said, let's fill it. Let's help these people out. Let's fill it.
And by the time we finished, that boat was full. And we got down there, and Randy flew down ahead of the boat, got there, and got everything schmoozed over with the government. Now, that was the first time.
That boat is how many feet?
That boat's 88 feet long.
Just to put it in, yeah. That's a big...
88 feet long, 22 feet wide.
That's a big ship.
And the hold is 11 and a half feet tall, and it was full. Hmm. But Randy went down, flew down ahead of everybody, got to Puerto Plata, went in and met with the government. Now, to give you an idea of the task he had in front of him, there was another group there who had been there 2 to 3 weeks.
From Canada.
A Canadian group who had
brought medical supplies.
We came in. They had been there a couple of weeks by the time we got there, and they were still there a couple of weeks after we left. And Randy went in and cleaned it out from the top to the bottom and got it done, and we moved.
Well, I think, you know, one of the reasons that really happened, and again, it certainly is a testimony to the worldwide impact of the church, is there were some people in our ward who knew somebody, an elderly couple, that was serving in Puerto Plata on a mission. And so we contacted them. So when I got off the plane, they were standing there with a sign, you know, because I was totally lost. You know, I didn't know where I was going to be going. And the first person they introduced me to was the stake president in Puerto Plata, a young man in his 30s who speaks perfect English. And he accompanied me every single day. He left his business and accompanied me every day as we went through the process with the government. And I remember when we first got in there to meet with these people, you know, they were pretty authoritative, and they wanted to tell you exactly how it was going to go. And President Reynoso, Eduardo Reynoso, who was the state president, and they were so amazed that I called him president, and they kept saying, what's he the president of? You know, is he the president?
He's younger than you. And
yeah, he was younger than me. He's a president? You know, we're going, yeah, he's president of the church in this area. And again, a great man, and he was able to work with them. And it was interesting, the night that we finally got the boat released, and as the boat was sailing off, the three of us standing on the dock was President Reynoso, the head government official, and myself. And we were standing there. And I just thought, what a miracle that we even got that boat through there. Because, again, that Canadian group was there for weeks afterwards. And, you know, so it really is a testimony to the worldwide influence of the church. And it's really refreshing that you can go to places like this and look up who's the church leader. And right away, certainly you've got an affinity with them because you're all members of the church. And this man who wasn't got a missionary experience as we explained what a stake president was.
So did they offload all of those goods right there, or did you move it somewhere else?
No, they brought their trucks in right there and offloaded it and took it to a warehouse right there for distribution to the people.
How many times have you done this?
We've done it actually three times now.
Mm-hmm.
But that was our first time.
Right.
And that was a learning curve. And now that we have our own permit and our own contract down there, one of the aspects of our contract is we clear customs very, very, very quickly. And as long as they know that it's being given away and we're not charging for it, they come in, they look at it, they write it on the list, sign it, and then we're free to give it out. Works out very well.
The last time we did this, we solicited a lot of donations from local church members, didn't we?
Yeah, well, we have a couple trailers, and we just park those in the church parking lot, and we just announce that this is going to be happening, and so all the people clean out their closets. And we take eyeglasses, we take clothing, we take food. Now, we found, even though the church is very, very, very generous, 18,000 pounds of rice and beans is a big deal, but getting it from here to there was the expensive aspect of it.
There being Florida?
Yeah, to Key West, where the boat departs from.
Right.
So now what we do is we just take donations, and we just buy it right from Costco, right down there in Florida. And the Dominicans love American rice because it's blanched and it's not all sticky. And so when they know that rice is coming, they line up for it because they love it, and it's pretty good.
How is it distributed to
We do it two ways. Well, three ways, actually. Our crew, when we know there's a boat coming down, we have a fellow by the name of Chicho. And I don't know one Dominican uses his real name. His real name is not Chicho. They all go by nicknames. But Roberto, Domingo, and Chicho are our three main crew members of the Dominican down there. And what they do is they get a whole group of people that they know that need help. And we distribute right off the back of the boat when the boat arrives once we've cleared customs. We move in. We don't move into our dock until we've cleared customs. Once we've cleared customs, then we back into our slip. We have our own slip there now, and we just back in, and then the plank goes down, and then the food starts coming off. And we'll keep about a third of it on board. And then once the local people right there in Samanah have received what we had for them, then we bring our truck over. We have our own truck, and we load that up, and then we take that up into the hills. And that sounds funny, but there are subsistence farmers there. And, I mean, you'll go out there, and they'll have a dozen chickens, one or two dozen chickens that they eat the eggs from. They'll have a couple of pigs, and they'll have some banana trees and some coconut trees, and that's what they live off. And so then we go up to those areas, and we donate. We distribute the rice and the beans that we bring in. We distribute a lot of clothing in those areas where they normally don't get them. The hand tools and stuff like that we take down, like the hammers and the saws, those we distribute in town where there's a need for them, where there's local craftsmen who don't necessarily have all the tools that we would have. I've only ever seen one building level in that country.
Well, one of the carpenters that worked in the museum, for instance, had to cut a lot of wooden planks, and all he had to cut it with was a blade from a hacksaw, a metal hacksaw blade that he was cutting wood with. That was it.
So you give this guy a skill saw, and he thinks he's died and gone to heaven.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, whatever you give them.
Yeah,
they're very appreciative. You know, to put this in perspective, Bob, the unemployment in Samanah, which is where our museum is and where we dock our boats usually, the unemployment is around 70%. Which is just astounding. I mean, it's hard to believe. And these people, they just live on the land, a lot of them. You know, you look at the coconut trees, the banana trees, and, you know, that's where they're getting their food. And so when we come in and bring anything to them, they're so appreciative of it. It's just a miracle to them that something like this is happening.
You know, and the biggest problem the Dominican Republic had, of course, was the earthquake in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
Because now the whole world's attention went to Haiti. Well, Haiti has 80% unemployment. Dominican Republic has 70%. We're not far behind. And yet we're quantum leaps ahead of Haiti. But now all of a sudden the stuff that was coming to the Dominican Republic fell off. And it was a real economic burden to the Dominican Republic. At least that's the way we saw it, you know. So we did what we could to step in there and help out. The other thing that is really cool down there, no matter where you go, you see kids playing baseball with sticks and a rock for a bat. So we went to all our ward members and said, if you got any old baseball equipment or toys, send them down. We took down boxes of baseballs and bats, and they're everywhere now.
Yeah. You know, there's a little field where they play baseball there in Samaná. And the last time – well, actually, it's the only time I've been there, but I walked over to the field because there was a bunch of teams having baseball practice. And they were having batting practice and fielding practice and a bunch of different things. But the interesting thing was I saw – you know, there were maybe 40 different baseballs rolling around these fields. I saw maybe two baseballs that actually had leather on them. They just use whatever they can find. And so the last time we took things down, we hoped to do a little more in terms of baseball equipment, but we didn't have enough time to contact some of the local teams and colleges and things to get donations from them. But next time, that's something we certainly want to do. You know, it's not food and clothing, but it's something that really means a lot to them. The Dominicans play a lot of baseball, and we want to take some baseball equipment down and help out the local teams and maybe even sponsor some of the local teams down there and help them out.
Another thing that's very, very this is not meant to sound condescending, but everybody down there is relatively poor. And so they all live in really small, poor homes. Now, you get into Santo Domingo, that's another story. There's some beautiful homes. But out in the country, it's all small little shacks, smaller than this production room. And they'll have a tin roof and tin walls. Everybody lives in that. The one thing they have that they can be proud of is their clothing. And clothing that we would normally look at and say, well, that's a little threadbare, worn out. To them, that's almost brand new. And so it was really fun because last time we were getting ready to go, my daughters cleaned out their closets. And we sent all these clothes down. And we sent down 18 boxes of clothes from my ward and Randy's ward and Ron's ward. Everybody kind of pitches in and stuff comes to the office. And then it goes to the church on Sunday. But I was talking to my daughter who was working down there on the boat. And she says, really cool, because I was walking down the street, and here come two of my dresses walking towards me that she recognized.
Well, I saw it even funnier when the electrician that came to work on the museum, of course, he didn't speak any English, but he had a T-shirt that said Young Women's Camp, Heber City, Utah on it.
So. You know what? In spite of the poverty, one thing you have to say about those people is that they do have some pride. And the clothing, even though it's old and maybe worn out, it's clean. And these people, they're beautiful people. They're clean. They take care of themselves. And that's just an amazing thing to see when you go down there, too. They love anything.
It really is a little different. When we fly back home into New York or Atlanta and you see, you know, I hate to be, again, condescending to our own people, but everyone in America seems so cold, yet those people down there are so happy and smiling and will give you anything. And it's a real dichotomy.
Oh, and talk about fixed stuff. I mean, these guys, I was driving down the road one day, middle of a hurricane. It was Hurricane Hannah, in between Gustav and Ike, the one with the H. I think it was Hannah. I'm driving down the road, and the radiator goes out of my truck. So I have, actually, it was the head gasket went out of my truck. And so there's steam boiling out of my truck. The guy comes in with a garden hose, takes the radiator cap off, stuffs the garden hose in my radiator, puts the hose up underneath my windshield wiper. And I don't speak a lot of Spanish, but he gets me to understand that when it gets too hot, fill it up with water. I drove that thing for 11 hours like that. And I'd pull up to somebody's house, go up and say, agua. And they'd run out and give you water and fill up your truck again for you, and away you go. And they're just wonderful. And they can fix anything.
What is it like? Tell me the feeling standing on the bow of that boat, and you back into that slip, and you see these people waiting for what you have.
You know, I think the easiest way to describe it is Doctrine and Covenants section 64. Be not weary in well-doing, for you're laying the foundations of a great work, and out of small things proceedeth forth that which is great. I really think that's it. You know, we're not gonna change that many lives with what we do down there, but we're laying a foundation, and that's really the bottom line to it. There's a lot of people that we make a lot of difference to. We won't make a big difference. We're not going to change this country, but we're going to change one or two lives, and that's important to me.
That's a great story. Have you had people that have you've been doing this for 4 or 5 years now? When was the first time that you dropped off?
The first time we did was when
I was down there
when Randy went down on and did all that stuff in Puerto Plata, and that was kind of sad in a way because I think it could have gone out further, And we don't know the end result of that. And it's not that we want to see the end result, but we want to know that the end result went to the people we had planned it for, which were the poorer people. Mm-hmm. So now when we take it in, it goes, because we clear customs ourselves now, we don't have that problem. So we can put the stuff on the truck and take it up to El Baya. And to give you an idea of El Baya, it's a, you go up this mountain road, down a mountain road, down off of a tropical rainforest, drive through a river and round a corner on a dirt road, and then there's a bunch of little houses and a little old tin can Seventh-day Adventist church. We have some really good shareholders in our company who are Seventh-day Adventists. They send stuff down to us too. And so then that's distributed amongst that congregation down there at El Baya. That's the proper name for it, isn't it?
El Baya, yeah.
And, I mean, that kind of stuff is really nice. And then you go up some trails, and there's a couple little old shacks up the end of those trails. And these people, there'll be a woman there with three or four kids. And you go in and you hand them a package of clothes for their kids and some rice and beans, and they really appreciate it.
You know, one thing that strikes you when you first get there, you look at the poverty and you think, wow, it must be hard for these people. They must be living difficult lives. But you spend a little time there, and you realize these people are happier than we are. They don't need what we need. They're happy with what they have, and they don't have much, but you know what? They're very content and happy. But when they get a little something extra, boy, it's sure nice for them. The last time we were there, we went to church up in Nagua, which is about an hour and a half from Samana, where our museum is, and we drove into the parking lot, and I thought, well, we must have had the wrong time because there aren't any cars here. There was one other car in the parking lot and a couple of motorcycles. And I thought we must have the wrong time. We walked into the chapel. No, we were late. There were 60 or 70 people in there, but they don't have cars. You know, they had walked or taken the bus. That's how they get around. But you know what? They're happy people, and they're very content.
Yeah, and the other thing that I noticed about Nagua, too, at the church there, the leadership, hey? The guy who was conducting the meetings, he looked like he might have just been a returned missionary.
Maybe got been back a year.
Yeah.
He was in the bishopric.
And he was the first counselor in the bishopric. The bishop was out that day. But, you know, that's the other thing. I mean, this is a Mormon program, so I work in the temple here in Utah. Mm-hmm. I was in the Jordan River Temple for several years and over to the Draper Temple. Randy worked in the Jordan Temple. And we get down to the Dominican Republic, walk into the temple down there with our temple recommends. I usually take my daughters, who before Carrie went on her mission, of course, she could only do baptisms for the dead. So we go down there, and that temple services all the islands. It serves Jamaica. It serves the Antigua. It serves Cuba. And if they were a member of church in Cuba, that would be their temple district. It serves the Lesser Antilles.
Puerto Rico.
Yeah, Nagua, all through those areas. And so the languages they speak, Spanish, French, and English. Well, there's very few English temple workers. So I walk in there, and as soon as they see me, it's, come on, Brother Bloom, we're heading down to the baptistry, and I get to work in the baptistry like an ordinary baptistry worker, and it's fantastic. You know, so, and the temple is just beautiful. It is one of the prettiest temples in the world. You know how Hawaii's set up there?
Yes.
Well, this temple looks like the Rexburg Temple, except it's all surrounded by palm trees and beautiful, beautiful flowers. And then all of the walkways are beautiful marble. And it is probably the prettiest building in all of the Dominican Republic.
And they're very proud of it, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting, too. One of the men we work with, a man by the name of Pedro Borrell.
That's a story for another time. But when you have another program, maybe we can talk about that. But, yeah, the Pedro Borrell is the gentleman in the Dominican Republic that he is the one that had to put the final stamp of approval on the contract for Deep Blue to get our contract on the North Shore. A fellow that we had heard his name for years, 30 years ago, there was an article in the National Geographic talking about him and the areas that he was over in the Dominican Republic. Well, he's still there, and everyone had told us, you know, you've got to watch out for him, be afraid of him. He's not going to give you your permit. He's a tough guy to work with. Well, it finds out, we come to find out that this man is a friend of the church, and when he found out we were LDS, after we had our contract, we found this out, that he's actually an architect by trade. He has designed all of the chapels that are used in the Caribbean. He was a project manager on the Santo Domingo Temple, and we found this out simply by sitting with him at breakfast one morning after he had been at our open house for the museum with the grand opening, sitting at breakfast with him one morning, just one-on-one talking to him and finding out a little bit about him, and he opened up and told us all these things that we hadn't known before. So that was interesting to find that connection to Pedro.
Yeah.
Where does Deep Blue Marine go from here?
Hopefully to the bottom of the ocean. Where do we go from here? Well, we want to open an English as a second language school. One of the things we noticed in the tourist industry in Samaná, when they laid off everybody in this last round of layoffs, they only laid off the people who could not speak English. And we have our museum there, and there's 3 or 4 hours a night that our museum sits empty, and we have actually space there where we could teach English as a second language. We would like to do that. We're also trying to make affiliations with several different humanitarian service people here in Utah to do dental work. And also, one of the travesties in the Dominican Republic is the health care is okay, but you'll notice I have my boat captain up here now for health care.
Mm-hmm.
And you will see more amputated legs and arms there than any place I've ever been in my life. And so when you go see the local hospital, you'll understand why that is. So we're working with a group here right now that not only will send doctors, but they'll send medicine and equipment that stays in that country. And so once they've taught people how to do the specific procedures they want to accomplish, they leave all the equipment and the medicine for them to be able to do that. And that's another thing we're looking at real seriously of doing. And that'll take us a year to get that put to bed. Our contracts there are good. We 30-month contract with the right to renew it every 30 months. And we have enough work there for the next 30 to 40 years. I'll be dead and gone long before that contract finishes. So that's kind of where we look at it. We'll be there for a long time.
Very interesting. Thank you for being here today. It's been a great experience learning more about the incredible work and miracles that are going into your project every day. Definitely a great example of faith in action. To learn more about this program and others we offer on the Mormon Channel, visit our website, mormonchannel.org. If you have questions or an idea you'd like us to explore, please email us at mormonchannel@ldschurch.org. And join us again next time on Faith in Action.